From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Our topic, combating violent extremism. Our guest, Yasir Qadi. He's a Muslim cleric and professor of religion at Rhodes College in the state of Tennessee. At a recent White House summit to combat violent extremism, U.S. President Barack Obama called on a group of community and religious leaders to help fight the, quote, false promises of extremism and reject the notion that terrorist groups represent Islam. The Obama administration has been careful not to single out Islamic extremism, but all forms of extremism, especially as we witness the rise of far-right political parties in Europe and elsewhere, many of which are anti-Semitic and Islamophobic, not to mention the continued presence of militant anti-federal government groups here in the United States. At this summit, President Obama appealed directly to prominent Muslims to do more to distance themselves from brutal ideologies. He told delegates that the fight against extremism could not be won with military might alone. The United States and its allies are struggling with the rapid, bloody rise of the extremist group, the self-proclaimed Islamic State, also known as ISIL, in Iraq and Syria, and recent terrorist attacks in Australia, Canada, France, and Denmark. In the United States this week, Pamela Geller, a leading anti-Muslim agitator who heads an organization called the American Freedom Defense Initiative, sponsored something called the Muhammad Art Exhibit and Cartoon Contest in Garland, Texas. The event clearly offended many people, especially Muslims, as the contest, while billed as a freedom of speech event, was held in response to a January event in the same town titled Stand with the Prophet in Honor and Respect. Geller, who goes out of her way to portray Islam in the most negative light, posits that Islam, not just radical Islam, threatens to destroy the United States. The cartoon contest triggered an attack by two individuals who were later shot by law enforcement. Geller knew that by staging the controversial event featuring irreverent depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, that she would provoke an outcry, if not violence. Well, to talk with us about this event and the delicate line between free speech and hate speech, as well as the daunting challenges of fighting violent extremism around the world, is Yasir Qadi. And Professor Yasir Qadi joins us from the studios of WKNO-FM in Memphis, Tennessee. Professor Qadi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And I'm delighted to welcome, as always, my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Thank you.
Well, Professor Qadi, you are considered a leading Muslim American scholar who helps explain extremism and the so-called misinterpretation of Islam. Where did that come from? What is your background?
Well, it wasn't something that I intentionally set out to do with my life. The fact of the matter is that it just so happened that I went to go study Islamic studies in a pre-9/11 world, much better world than we find ourselves in now. It was 1995, and I was a young graduate in chemical engineering. And I went on a spiritual quest to better understand my faith. And I went overseas to the Islamic University of Medina, where I spent the next 10 years. And 9/11 happened when I was studying at the University of Medina. And so really, I didn't go in, you know, knowing the world would be such a radically different place. I went in at a very innocent time. And when I came back to America, I realized that I really do have to build bridges of understanding between the two different civilizations, the Islamic world and the American world. I feel fully a part of both worlds. I'm an American, I'm a Muslim. And I've lived in the Middle East for more than a decade. Of course, I'm born and raised in America. So I really felt the need that there's just a lot of misunderstanding and a lot more dialogue needs to be done. One thing led to another, and here I am being interviewed on so many talk shows and interviews and writing articles and just speaking out against what I view to be extremist elements on both sides of the Atlantic.
Thank you for the background, Professor Qadi. Let's go right into the incident in Texas, where Pamela Geller, a New Yorker, she's a leading anti-Muslim agitator here in the United States. She held this so-called Muhammad Art Exhibit and Cartoon Contest clearly to provoke a reaction. Of course, nobody would ever justify the violence that was committed in response to this contest. However, let me get your reaction to this event and the killing, of course, by law enforcement of the two individuals who were protesting this event.
So as you correctly pointed out, nobody really wants any violence. And it's very interesting to note that the Dallas Muslim community collectively and effectively boycotted the incident completely. Nothing at all was planned. Not even protests were planned. There are a number of my own friends that are involved with the Dallas community, and they said, we didn't even want to bring attention to this because it really is hate speech. The two individuals that actually were involved drove down from Arizona, and one of them was on the radar of the FBI for the last 5-6 years. So really, you cannot monitor or police 7-8 million people, the American Muslims. Again, it's not wise on the part of people to provoke minorities. And when those minorities do respond back, of course, all of us are angry. But the question arises, what is to be gained? Let me give you an analogous example. Would we support the right of the KKK to basically use derogatory terms and plaster the N-word, let's say, in paintings and diagrams and have very, very provocative art exhibits where the African-American people are denigrated? I mean, this is free speech. Nobody's going to deny that. But what is to be gained by constantly harassing, by constantly provoking a group? And, you know, if one or two African-Americans did happen to react to such a KKK event, obviously they would go to jail and we would tell them, why would you do that? But at the same time, you would take a step back and ask the organizers of the event, what were you thinking? I mean, why would you do such a thing? So, of course, I'm angry at these two individuals from my own Muslim community who reacted in this manner. But I also have to ask that, what is the purpose of engaging with the minority community in such a provocative manner? And what is to be gained by doing that?
Well, indeed. And in fact, it appears that Ms. Geller actually created what I would call a self-fulfilling prophecy. She knew that what she was doing was extremely provocative and perhaps even felt a certain amount of glee about the result, which is all the more unfortunate. But let me turn now to my colleague Mohammed El-Shanawi for a question.
Professor Qadi, if Prophet Muhammad himself did not respond to personal attacks and mocking by violence, how would some Muslims today kill people who draw cartoons depicting the Prophet?
That's a very good question. We all know as Muslims that the Prophet Muhammad always turned the other cheek. He was very forgiving to those who opposed him. And this is the image that Muslims have of the Prophet. Now, it is true that some people outside the faith try to portray the Prophet as a warmonger, as this and that. But the image that Muslims have of their Prophet is really similar to the image that Christians have of Jesus. And that is that he was a loving, a peaceful Prophet who forgave his opponents. And there are many instances in the life of the Prophet that Muslims grew up hearing about. So the question arises, where is this anger and where is this justification coming from? And the response to this is that one cannot ignore the socio-political context from within which these provocations arise. The fact of the matter is that Islam has been slandered for the last 14 centuries. Like every religion, people go back and forth. But it is not common in the history of Islam to have radical terrorist groups or to have vigilantes going and killing people, you know, who defamed the Prophet. This is a relatively modern phenomenon. The very notion of Islamic terrorism is relatively modern. It only goes back to the 70s and early 80s. And one does need to ask, why is this happening only recently? And the response is that one cannot ignore the political dimension, pre-colonialism, post-colonialism, the invasions of so many Muslim lands, the support of dictator regimes. All of these things are not simply disparate issues. They are interconnected. And when a community feels marginalized, and I can assure you the Muslim community is feeling marginalized, any type of attack on that which is sacred and holy kind of brings out all of those emotions, all of those tensions. And it is a sad reality that, yes, when you attack the Prophet, you are going to get these reactions. It's almost inevitable. And I agree with you that Pamela Geller did seem to be instigating and gleefully accepting the fact that she was attacked. She was banking on it because it did boost her to a level of popularity that she now has.
But Professor, American Muslim youth had been spared the alienation that fostered militancy in Europe. How do you explain homegrown terrorism by some Muslim Americans?
You know, I used to say around 6-7 years ago that all Islamic jihadist terrorist attacks by Muslims have occurred by people who were not born and raised in America. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we've actually seen a few instances, just a handful, and the two individuals as well that were responsible for the Dallas shooting, they are as well American. And it's just a sad reality that, unfortunately, unless we take a step back and ask ourselves why there is so much anger. I mean, again, let me give you an analogous situation. Look at Ferguson, look at Baltimore, look at the tensions within the African-American and the larger dominant Caucasian populations. You cannot dissociate this ongoing narrative. And if a young African-American does something, let's say in New York, you can ask him, why would you get irritated when you're not in Ferguson, you're not in Baltimore? But see, there is this alliance. There is this notion of all of us are being attacked. And frankly, there's an element of truth in that narrative. So it is true that, yes, eventually even American Muslims will fall prey to that narrative that ISIS is spreading, that other groups are spreading, that all Muslims are under attack, all Muslims are under siege, that they're out to get you. This war on terror is nothing other than a war on Islam. And when we continue our foreign policies, we continue our drones and our assassinations and our supporting of military dictators, when we selectively choose who to defend and who not to defend, i.e. the innocent Syrians that are being massacred, they're not being defended. When we selectively choose, then that narrative is given certain credence and people do fall prey to it. And this is not a justification. Of course, I strongly disagree with that narrative, but it is inevitable when blood is continued to be shed, when violence is continued to be perpetrated, that more and more people will identify with the victims and feel that they need to do something against those whom they view as being actively involved in propagating that violence.
We're speaking with Yasser Qadi. He's a Muslim cleric and professor of religion at Rhodes College in the state of Tennessee. Well, Professor Qadi, let's go on to one other event that occurred last week. We witnessed that the Penn American Center's literary gala gave an award for freedom of expression and courage to the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Of course, we know that this was a satirical magazine that, among other things, drew cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Again, it was their contention that this was free speech. They were mocking violent extremism as exhibited by Islamist extremism. But others saw it differently. But of course, once again, we're going to all sort of go out of our way to say that nothing ever justifies violence, and the killing of the employees at Charlie Hebdo and others are deplorable and heinous. Nonetheless, it still brings up the topic of the delicate line between free speech and hate speech. And of course, many people, not only Muslims, were offended by such cartoons. And of course, there's the concept of blasphemy in Islam. So the question to you is, how do we draw the line between, you know, free speech and hate speech? When do we know that free speech veers into hate speech? And then the second question is, some say, just like the denial of the Holocaust is criminalized in Europe in particular, that perhaps certain heinous attacks on the Prophet and the Quran should also be criminalized as hate speech and incitement.
So with regards to the first question, when does free speech constitute hate speech? I think this is pretty self-evident. You just need to look at what is the goal. Is it an academic critique or is it merely meant to provoke and intimidate? And I really think satire, when it is used by a dominant majority against an already persecuted minority, I think satire actually borders on pre-genocidal brainwashing. And how can you ignore the fact that in that very region, in that very society, I'm talking about, you know, Europe and sections of Europe, the same type of satire was used pre-Holocaust against another minority. And that helped the animosity and that expedited, if you like, the blind eye that was turned to the Holocaust against the Jews. The fact of the matter is that satire is not funny when it is used to provoke an already estranged, an already marginalized group of people by a dominant majority. And if you look at the cartoons, and I mean, I don't know how many people have actually seen the cartoons, and I wouldn't suggest looking at them, but I can assure you, anybody who looks at those cartoons will realize there is absolutely no academic merit. It is simply derogatory. I mean, as a Muslim, I can say blasphemous, but there's nothing to be gained by doing this. And every society has its own social taboos. Here in America, we are never, ever going to use the N-word. No politician, no satirical magazine of any respectable value is going to publicize the N-word or portray African Americans in a certain manner, and that's healthy. We're not going to make jokes about the Holocaust. We're not going to crack jokes about Jews being, let's say, whatever, the stereotypes that exist. These things are simply not going to be done. You're not going to see a mainstream magazine making fun of our troops that have died in battle overseas or making fun of their courage. That just doesn't happen. There are certain things you just don't do. Do we mock the 9/11 victims as they jumped out of the buildings? Are you going to see a magazine, you know, making fun of them? you're never, ever going to see anything of that nature here in America. Why? Well, because there's sensibilities. I mean, you just don't do that. There's just no point in doing that. So is it legal? Of course it's legal. But who would do that? And if anybody were to do that, well, we see the reality. Sometimes news broadcasters or comedians do cross the line and they get into a lot of trouble. Politicians can never, ever be forgiven if they make a faux pas, such as using the N-word. That's it. Their whole career is gone. Is anybody going to call for their defending of free speech? No. So here's the point that Muslims feel, and I ask my listeners as well to think about this. It appears there are certain double standards. It appears that certain types of free speech are promoted, hate speech is promoted as free speech, anti-Islamic bigotry, whereas other types of hate speech, while legal, is never recourse to, and in fact, nobody defends it. And you correctly pointed out another very difficult dichotomy to explain, and that is that it is a criminal offense in, I believe, 15 countries in Europe to make fun of the Holocaust or to even deny the numbers, i.e. if somebody says the Holocaust was 5 million versus 6 million or something, you actually face a penalty and you go to jail. Now, why do we not find groups across the world championing the right to free speech in those countries? Why do we not find Americans, you know, writing about this and saying it's so unfair that people are not allowed to criticize, even if it's immoral and unethical? Why can't they do that? It's just dead silent. You don't find anybody defending the free speech in that category. So here, Muslims do feel there does seem to be a selective choosing of what free speech to defend. Do I personally want to see such speech criminalized? I'm an American. I support the First Amendment. So no, I don't want to see it criminalized. However, I do want to see it socially ostracized, and that's a totally different issue altogether.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Yasir Qadhi. He's a Muslim cleric and professor of religion at Rhodes College in Tennessee, and he is joining us from the studios of WKNO-FM in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior Middle East Reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, and connect with us on Facebook or send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Japan, Mr. Monta Tanaka. And now a question from my colleague, Mohammed.
Another fine line we hope you can explain to our audience. Does Islamic law endorse the legitimacy of armed resistance against Western forces in Muslim territories as a duty of jihad?
Whoa, that's a very explicit question, and I'll attempt to answer it, although I probably not going to be as precise as you want me to be. Let me take a step back and say, I think it's true to say every single society, every single group of people, civilization, religion, has within its understanding of living some type of just war theory, some type of defense mechanism. No civilization is going to sit back and allow another civilization to invade. That's human nature. So does Islam have a just war theory? Of course it does, but then so does every other civilization. And Islam calls that just war theory jihad. And so from an Islamic perspective, jihad is nothing other than fighting for illegitimate reason, just like we in America, like every civilization has reasons it goes to war. And in an Islamic civilization, of course, there's going to be a religious motif to that war as well. There's going to be religious blessings. There's going to be a divine ordination. There's going to be supernatural or spiritual causes as well. So, of course, every religious society will have that. The question, though, that you're asking me is a very specific one, and that is, should people in specific countries, you know, fight against foreign invaders? And the answer to that question now changes from theory to reality. And that's where I have to take a step back and say, every society, every civilization needs to decide what is the best way to preserve its own values when they are challenged. That's not my job to say, sitting, you know, in a studio in Memphis, what Syrians should do, what Iraqis should do, what Jordanians should do. That's really up to them to think about. But let me just say, there are many analogous situations. I mean, when the French were occupied by Nazi Germany, I mean, what did they do? Many of them accept a status quo, and many of them fought back. There are going to be different opinions, and history does belong to the victor. The fact that French eventually gained independence, we glorify those who fought that independence against the Nazis. We glorify the resistance movements. I don't know what would have happened if they hadn't won, but the fact of the matter is, it is undeniable that every civilization does have a defense mechanism and a just war theory, and Islam is no different.
But what role does repression play in attracting young Muslims to join violent extremist groups like ISIS?
What role does the repression play? I would say it plays a primary role. I would say it plays the primary role. It is my contention and the contention of many researchers that it is not the Quran that radicalizes young men and women. It is not the teachings of Islam. It is socioeconomic and political circumstances, grievances that are being expressed in the language of religion. And again, I point out that in the history of Islam's 14 and a half centuries, and I'm not painting a utopic, romanticized past, of course Islam had its ups and downs. Relatively speaking, Islam did not see anything similar, anything analogous to the types of violence or the resistance movements or the jihadist movements that we've seen in the last 20 to 30 years. So the question arises, why now? What is going on in these particular lands? As well, you mentioned the point of ISIS. So is it a coincidence that ISIS is arising from Iraq? I mean, one needs to take a step back and ask oneself, what has happened in Iraq in the last 35 years? Iraq, a country that used to be in the 60s and 70s and even up until the 80s, one of the leading, if not the most technologically advanced civilization in the Middle East. The greatest healthcare, the greatest education system, the University of Baghdad was perhaps the most prestigious Arab university in the 70s and early 80s. What has happened since that point in time to bring Iraq really to the current situation and status quo? And when one takes a look back, one sees political circumstances, invasions, boycottings, regime changes, toppling, supporting of one faction over another. One cannot ignore all of these factors. Does repression play a role in radicalization? Of course it does. It plays the primary role in radicalization.
Professor Qadi, I'd like to follow up briefly. What about the West's inaction of late, particularly to defend Syria's peaceful protesters and the Free Syria Army against the brutal oppression of the Bashar al-Assad regime? We recall that President Obama drew the famous red line when Assad used chemical weapons against his own people, and of course, notwithstanding the U.S.-Russia agreement to remove or destroy Syria's chemical weapon arsenal, which could be considered a very good thing. But to what extent did this sort of inaction on the part of the West and the so-called Friends of Syria to really help these peaceful protesters who really only resorted to violence to defend themselves, but we see now the growth of these Islamist groups, ISIL. To what extent does all of this play into the growth of jihadism, the West's inaction on the one hand, and perhaps the sense of despair on the other, and people then resorting to backing jihadists because they seem to be the only people who are willing to take on, you know, the brutality of the Assad regime?
Again, this is precisely the point. You hit the nail on the head. When people are being massacred, President Bashar al-Assad has killed, murdered more than 1 million of his own citizens. Over 7 million refugees have been created in his own country. And yet the world stands idly by. Now here's the point. Groups like ISIS and others are not angry at, let's just say, Uruguay for doing nothing, because Uruguay doesn't claim to get involved in world affairs. But we have a country such as our own, I'm talking about America, that clearly claims that it is championing freedom, that has a huge role in many Middle Eastern countries, that chooses to bomb, to attack, to support particular regimes or entities. And therefore, when it doesn't do what it does in other places, people are going to accuse it of double standards. Let me give you one example where, let's say, the Yazidis were being harassed and intimidated and perhaps even persecuted and killed by ISIS. And of course, my sympathies are with the Yazidis here. America took action and they bombed ISIS. How about the millions of people of Syria that have been attacked by their own government? The entire world stands by doing nothing. What do you think is going to happen in the minds of a young Syrian who sees the world doing nothing, and here he sees a radical group fighting what, from his perspective, on his behalf? He sees this jihadist group from his perspective. He views them as being freedom fighters that are fighting the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And they are claiming, look at America, they're not helping us at all. And yet they're supporting Bashar, they're tacitly doing this, they're doing that. From his narrative, in his imagination, yes, America does become the great evil entity, because he's being fed this narrative of half-truths, of stereotypes. And frankly, there's an element here of, yes, there are some issues we're going to have to face. And that is, for example, why aren't we helping the Syrian people? Why are we selectively bombing certain targets rather than others? And those are questions I'm afraid I don't have answers to.
Well, three quick points that I'd like to make. Not only Syrians are wondering, but some Americans are going over, because they are also seeing the brutality of the Assad regime, and of course foreign fighters from here in the United States and Europe going over to try to help the Syrians fight against Assad. Secondly, of course, the United States is one of the top aid givers to the Syrians. But again, these are band-aids, one could say. It's very good that we're helping perhaps with shelter and other supplies, but we're looking at band-aid and not attacking the roots of the problem. And then thirdly, President Obama was the president who wanted to be the anti-Bush. He does not want to get involved in the Middle East in a military way. Nobody was asking for boots on the ground, but again, he's very reluctant. His view vis-a-vis how to deal with Syria is reflective of that reluctance. Now, we've talked a lot about the political roots, the sense of despair on the part of many people, what drives them to violent extremism. What about theology and ideology? You know, many say that the Wahhabi doctrine of Saudi Arabia is not that much different than the ideological underpinnings of the so-called Islamic State or ISIL, that ISIL just takes these rigid beliefs to an extreme and uses violence to enforce them. It appears to some scholars that the Wahhabi or Salafi doctrine of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states is not so much pure Islam, but it's rather sort of like a conflation of Islamic tenets with lots of tribal traditions and customs from the Bedouin culture blended in. Because you mentioned yourself about the heyday of Islam in Spain, Al-Andalus, from the 8th to the 13th centuries. We had a terrific dynasty from Damascus. There was great tolerance of all Abrahamic faiths, in stark contrast to what we're seeing emanating from some of these Gulf states and Saudi Arabia in particular. So talk about the theological and ideological underpinnings of these Islamist groups.
It is true there is some overlap between Salafism or Wahhabism and between ISIS. But at the same time, let us not forget that some of the most vocal and powerful and effective criticisms of ISIS have come from within the Salafi paradigm. And these criticisms actually do have the most impact because they do share some similarities with the overall worldview. So I think it is unfair to simply stereotype the entire Salafist movement, which is a very vast movement. Of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, these are mainstream Salafist worldviews espoused by the general public. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people. So I think one needs to be a little bit careful of stereotyping the entire group. It is true that they do have some ultra-conservative views about monotheism, about veneration of graves and whatnot, about images, but they're not that different from certain views in Protestant Puritan Christianity of demolishing statues of the Virgin Mary, let's say. So the fact that they might share some of that theology doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to enforce them the same way that ISIS does.
And in the few minutes we have left, Professor Qadi, how do you think we all can best challenge the extremist use of the internet and social media to recruit more vulnerable Muslims and others? And how can we best counter radical Islamist narrative, which often distorts the Quran?
It's not just a distortion of the Quran. It's not just a misunderstanding of the prophetic tenets. The root cause is anger. When you see these images of children being killed, of the Palestinian problem, of refugees, when you see bombs and drones, when you see dictators being supported, and then you see inaction, perhaps even hypocrisy, then you hear misinterpretation of Islam. Then that misinterpretation appeals to you. Simply having a misinterpretation of the Quran is not going to appeal to you without some cause of anger. And plenty of studies have been done on people that have gone over to ISIS, on people that have went radical, if you like. And the fact of the matter is, the one thing that strikes every researcher is there doesn't seem to be that much of extra religiosity in the lives of the people that go over to the dark side. But something clicks within them. So bottom line, we need a two-pronged attack, if you like. The first is to, yes, deconstruct their illegitimate arguments from the Quran, to show that this is not the prophetic methodology, to show that it is un-Islamic to do what they're doing. But there must be another effort as well, and that is to answer the legitimate criticisms that some of these movements have of, why do you support this particular dictator? Why are you not allowing freedom of expression in other lands, whereas you want to defame the Prophet in your own and say, this is a freedom of expression? Why are you bombing drones? Why are you doing this and that? These are questions that are political in nature. So there's a two-pronged effort, and I think perhaps people like myself are more comfortable in the first, but there have to be others that are actively engaged in showing the world that, yes, many Americans are aware that we do seem to have a failed Middle East foreign policy. We do seem to have certain double standards. And let the world know that not all Americans are the same. There are many critics of our foreign policy from within our land. Unfortunately, jihadists don't know that, and they think all Americans must be supporting what we're doing overseas. And I think if more and more Americans spoke out, not only would this show that the jihadists were wrong, hopefully, eventually, even our own policies would change for the better.
Yasir Qadi is a Muslim cleric and professor of religion at Rhodes College in the state of Tennessee. Professor Qadi, thank you for your terrific insights.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Thanks also to WKNO-FM in Memphis, Tennessee, for the use of their studio. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and joining me on the program was VOA Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.